Well now, the thing's done, said the trader, getting up. It's done, said Mr. Shelby in a musing tone. And fetching a long breath, he repeated, it's done. You don't seem to feel much pleased with it, Pierce, to me, said the trader. Haley, said Mr. Shelby, I hope you'll remember that you promised on your honor you wouldn't sell Tom, without knowing what sort of hands he's going into. Why, you've just done it, sir, said the trader. Circumstances you well know obliged me, said Shelby haughtily. Well, you know, they may oblige me too, said the trader. Howsomever, I'll do the very best I can in getting Tom a good berth. As to my treatin' on him bad, you needn't be a grain feared. If there's anything that I thank the Lord for, it is that I'm never no ways cruel. After the expositions which the trader had previously given of his humane principles, Mr. Shelby did not feel particularly reassured by these declarations. But as they were the best comfort the case admitted of, he allowed the trader to depart in silence, and betook himself to a solitary cigar. Chapter 5. Showing the Feelings of Living Property on Changing Owners. Mr. and Mrs. Shelby had retired to their apartment for the night. He was lounging in a large easy chair, looking over some letters that had come in the afternoon mail, and she was standing before her mirror, brushing out the complicated braids and curls in which Eliza had arranged her hair. For noticing her pale cheeks and haggard eyes, she had excused her attendance that night and ordered her to bed. The employment, naturally enough, suggested her conversation with the girl in the morning, and turning to her husband, she said carelessly, "By the by, Arthur, who was that low-bred fellow that you lugged in to our dinner-table today?"
"Haley is his name," said Shelby, turning himself rather uneasily in his chair, and continuing with his eyes fixed on a letter.
"Haley, who is he, and what may be his business here, pray?"
"Well, he's a man that I transacted some business with last time I was in Natchez," said Mr. Shelby.
"And he presumed on it to make himself quite at home, and call and dine here, aye?"
"Why, I invited him, and I had some accounts with him," said Shelby.
"Is he a negro trader?" said Mrs. Shelby, noticing a certain embarrassment in her husband's manner.
"Why, my dear, what put that into your head?" said Shelby, looking up.
"Nothing. Only Eliza came in here after dinner in a great worry, crying and taking on, and said that you were talking with a trader, and that she heard him make an offer for her boy. The ridiculous little goose."
"She did, eh?" said Mr. Shelby, returning to his paper, which he seemed for a few moments quite intent upon, not perceiving that he was holding it bottom upwards. "It will have to come out," said he, mentally, "as well now as ever."
"I told Eliza," said Mrs. Shelby, as she continued brushing her hair, "that she was a little fool for her pains, and that you never had anything to do with that sort of persons. Of course, I knew you never meant to sell any of our people, least of all to such a fellow."
"Well, Emily," said her husband,
"so I have always felt and said, but the fact is that my business lies so that I cannot get on without. I shall have to sell some of my hands."
"To that creature? Impossible! Mr. Shelby, you cannot be serious."
"I'm sorry to say that I am," said Mr. Shelby. "I've agreed to sell Tom."
"What? Our Tom? That good, faithful creature? Been your faithful servant from a boy? Oh, Mr. Shelby, and you have promised him his freedom, too. You and I have spoken to him 100 times of it. Well, I can believe anything now. I can believe now that you could sell little Harry, poor Eliza's only child," said Mrs. Shelby, in a tone between grief and indignation.
"Well, since you must know all?"
"It is so. I have agreed to sell Tom and Harry both. And I don't know why I am to be raided as if I were a monster for doing what everyone does every day."
"But why, of all others, choose these?" said Mrs. Shelby. "Why sell them, of all on the place, if you must sell at all?"
"Because they will bring the highest sum of any. That's why. I could choose another, if you say so. The fellow made me a high bid on Eliza, if that would suit you any better," said Mr. Shelby.
"Wretch!" said Mrs. Shelby vehemently.
"Well, I didn't listen to it a moment, out of regard to your feelings. I wouldn't. Give me some credit," "My dear," said Mrs. Shelby, recollecting herself, "forgive me, I have been hasty. I was surprised and entirely unprepared for this, but surely you will allow me to intercede for these poor creatures. Tom is a noble-hearted, faithful fellow. He is black, I do believe, Mr. Shelby, that if he were put to it, he would lay down his life for you."
"I know it. I dare say, but what's the use of all this? I can't help myself."
"Why not make a pecuniary sacrifice? I'm willing to bear my part of the inconvenience. Oh, Mr. Shelby, I have tried most faithfully, as a Christian woman should, to do my duty to these poor, simple, dependent creatures. I have cared for them, instructed them, watched over them, and know all their little cares and joys for years. And how can I ever hold up my head again among them, if for the sake of a little paltry gain we sell such a faithful, excellent, confiding creature as poor Tom, and tear from him in a moment all we have taught him to love and value? I have taught them the duties of the family, of parent and child, and husband and wife, and how can I bear to have this open acknowledgment that we care for no tie, no duty, no relation, however sacred, compared with money? I have talked with Eliza about her boy, her duty to him as a Christian mother, to watch over him, pray for him, and bring him up in a Christian way, and now what can I say? If you tear him away and sell him soul and body to a profane, unprincipled man, just to save a little money, I have told her that one soul is worth more than all the money in the world. And how will she believe me when she sees us turn around and sell her child? Sell him! Perhaps to certain ruin of body and soul?"
"I'm sorry you feel so about it. Indeed I am," said Mr. Shelby. "And I respect your feelings, too, though I don't pretend to share them to their full extent. But I tell you now, solemnly, it's of no use. Can't help myself. I didn't mean to tell you this, Emily, but in plain words there is no choice between selling these two and selling everything. Either they must go, or all must.
Haley has come into possession of a mortgage, which, if I don't clear off with him directly, will take everything before it. I've raked and scraped and borrowed and all but begged, and the price of these two was needed to make up the balance, and I had to give them up. Haley fancied the child. He agreed to settle the matter that way and no other. I was in his power, and had to do it. If you feel so to have them sold, would it be any better to have all sold?"
Mrs. Shelby stood like one stricken. Finally turning to her toilet, she rested her face in her hands and gave a sort of groan.
"This is God's curse on slavery, a bitter, bitter, most accursed thing, a curse to the master and a curse to the slave. I was a fool to think I could make anything good of such a deadly evil. It is a sin to hold a slave under laws like ours. I always felt it was. I always thought so when I was a girl. I thought so still more after I joined the church, but I thought I could gild it over. I thought by kindness and care and instruction I could make the condition of mine better. Freedom! Fool that I was!"
"Why, wife, you are getting to be an abolitionist, quite."
"Abolitionist! If they knew all I know about slavery, they might talk. We don't need them to tell us. You know I never thought that slavery was right, never felt willing to own slaves."
"Well, therein you differ from many wise and pious men," said Mr. Shelby. "You remember Mr. B.'s sermon the other Sunday?"
"I don't want to hear such sermons. I never wish to hear Mr. B. in our church again. Ministers can't help the evil, perhaps, can't cure it, any more than we can, but defend it.
It always went against my common sense, and I think you didn't think much of the sermon either." "Well," said Shelby, "I must say these ministers sometimes carry matters further than we poor sinners would exactly dare to do.
We men of the world must wink pretty hard at various things and get used to a deal that isn't the exact thing. But we don't quite fancy when women and ministers come out broad and square and go beyond us in matters of either modesty or morals. That's a fact. But now, my dear, I trust you see the necessity of the thing. And you see that I have done the very best the circumstances would allow."
"Yes, yes," said Mrs. Shelby, hurriedly and abstractedly fingering her gold watch. "I haven't any jewelry of any amount," she added, thoughtfully. "But would not this watch do something? It was an expensive one when it was bought. If I could only at least save Eliza's child, I would sacrifice anything I have."
"I'm sorry, very sorry, Emily," said Mr. Shelby. "I'm sorry this takes hold of you so, but it will do no good. The fact is, Emily, the thing's done. The bills of sales are already signed and in Haley's hands, and you must be thankful it is no worse. That man has had it in his power to ruin us all, and how he is fairly off. If you knew the man as I do, you'd think that we had had a narrow escape."
"Is he so hard, then?"
"Why, not a cruel man exactly, but a man of leather, a man alive to nothing but trade and profit, cool and unhesitating and unrelenting, as death in the grave. He'd sell his own mother at a good percentage, not wishing the old woman any harm, either. And this wretch owns that good faithful Tom, and Eliza's child. Well, my dear, the fact is that this goes rather hard with me. It's a thing I hate to think of. Haley wants to drive matters and take possession tomorrow. I'm going to get out my horse bright and early and be off. I can't see Tom. That's a fact. And you had better arrange a drive somewhere and carry Eliza off. Let the thing be done when she's out of sight.
No, no, said Mrs. Shelby. I'll be in no sense accomplice or help in this cruel business. I'll go and see poor old Tom. God help him in his distress. They shall see at any rate that their mistress can feel for and with them. As to Eliza, I dare not think about it. The Lord forgive us. What have we done? That this cruel necessity should come on us.
There was one listener to this conversation, whom Mr. and Mrs. Shelby little suspected. Communicating with their apartment was a large closet, opening by a door into the outer passage. When Mrs. Shelby had dismissed Eliza for the night, her feverish and excited mind had suggested the idea of this closet, and she had hidden herself there, and with her ear pressed close against the crack of the door, had lost not a word of the conversation. When the voices died into silence, she rose and crept stealthily away. Pale, shivering, with rigid features and compressed lips, she looked an entirely altered being from the soft and timid creature she had been hitherto. She moved cautiously along the entry, paused one moment at her mistress's door, and raised her hands in mute appeal to heaven, and then turned and glided into her own room. It was a quiet, neat apartment on the same floor with her mistress. There was a pleasant sunny window, where she had often sat singing at her sewing. There a little case of books, and various little fancy articles ranged by them. The gifts of Christmas holidays. There was her simple wardrobe in the closet, and in the drawers. Here was, in short, her home. And on the whole, a happy one it had been to her. But there on the bed lay her slumbering boy, his long curls, falling negligently around his unconscious face, his rosy mouth half open, his little fat hands furrowed out over the bedclothes, and a smile spread like a sunbeam over his whole face.
Poor boy. Poor fellow, said Eliza. They have sold you. But your mother will save you yet.
No tear dropped over that pillow in such straits as these. The heart has no tears to give. It drops only blood, bleeding itself away in silence. She took a piece of paper and a pencil and wrote hastily,
Oh, missus, dear missus, don't think me ungrateful. Don't think hard of me anyway.
I heard all you and master said tonight.
I am going to try and save my boy, and you will not blame me.
God bless and reward you for all your kindness. Hastily folding and directing this, she went to a drawer and made up a little package of clothing for her boy, which she tied with a handkerchief firmly round her waist. And so fond is a mother's remembrance that even in the terrors of that hour she did not forget to put in the little package one or two of his favorite toys, reserving a gaily painted parrot to amuse him when she should be called on to awaken him. It was some trouble to arouse the little sleeper, but after some effort he sat up and was playing with his bird while his mother was putting on her bonnet and shawl.
"Where are you going, mother?" said he, as she drew near the bed, with his little coat and cap.
His mother drew near, and looked so earnestly into his eyes, that he at once divined that something unusual was the matter.
"Hush, Harry," she said. "Mustn't speak loud, or they will hear us.
A wicked man was coming to take little Harry away from his mother, and carry him way off in the dark, but mother won't let him. She's going to put on her little boy's cap and coat and run off with him, so the ugly man can't catch him." Saying these words, she had tied and buttoned on the child's simple outfit, and taking him in her arms, she whispered to him to be very still, and opening a door in her room, which led into the outer veranda, she glided noiselessly out. It was a sparkling, frosty, starlit night, and the mother wrapped the shawl close round her child, as perfectly quiet with vague terror he clung round her neck. Old Bruno, of Great Newfoundland, who slept at the end of the porch, rose with a low growl as she came near. She gently spoke his name, and the animal, an old pet and playmate of hers, instantly wagging his tail, prepared to follow her, though apparently revolving much in the simple dog's head, what such an indiscreet midnight promenade might mean. Some dim ideas of imprudence or impropriety in the measure seemed to embarrass him considerably, for he often stopped as Eliza glided forward and looked wistfully, first at her and then at the house, and then, as if reassured by reflection, he pattered along after her again. A few minutes brought them to the window of Uncle Tom's cottage, and Eliza, stopping, tapped lightly on the window-pane. The prayer meeting at Uncle Tom's had, in the order of hymn-singing, been protracted to a very late hour, and, as Uncle Tom had indulged himself in a few lengthy solos afterwards, the consequence was that although it was now between 12 and 1 o'clock, he and his worthy helpmeet were not yet asleep.
"Good Lord, what's this?" said Aunt Chloe, starting up and hastily drawing the curtain. "My sakes, lad, if it ain't Lizzie! Get on your clothes, old man, quick! There's old Bruno, too, upon around! What on earth? I'm going to open the door!"
And suiting the action to the word, the door flew open, and the light of the tallow candle which Tom had hastily lighted fell on the haggard face and dark wild eyes of the fugitive. Lord bless you. I'm scared to look at you, Lizzie. Are you tuck sick, or what's come over you?
I'm running away. Uncle Tom and Aunt Chloe carrying off my child. Master sold him.
Sold him? Echoed both, lifting up their hands in dismay.
Yes, sold him, said Eliza firmly. I crept into the closet by Mistress's door tonight, and I heard Master tell Missus that he had sold my Harry, and you, Uncle Tom, both, to a trader, and that he was going off this morning on his horse, and that the man was to take possession today.
Tom had stood during the speech with his hands raised and his eyes dilated like a man in a dream. Slowly and gradually, as its meaning came over him, he collapsed, rather than seated himself, on his old chair and sunk his head down upon his knees.
The good Lord have pity on us, said Aunt Chloe. Oh, it don't seem as if it was true. What has he done? That master should sell him.
He hasn't done anything. It isn't for that. Master don't want to sell. And Missus, she's always good. I heard her plead and beg for us. But he told her 'tis was no use, that he was in this man's debt, and that this man had got the power over him, and that if he didn't pay him off clear, it would end in his having to sell the place and all the people and move off. Yes, I heard him say there was no choice between selling these two and selling all. The man was driving him so hard. Master said he was sorry, but, oh, Missus, you ought to have heard her talk. If she ain't a Christian and an angel, there never was one. I'm a wicked girl to leave her so, but then I can't help it. She said herself one soul was worth more than the world, and this boy has a soul, and if I let him be carried off, who knows what'll become of it.
It must be right, but if it ain't right, the Lord forgive me, for I can't help doing it.
Well, old man, said Aunt Chloe, why don't you go too? Will you wait to be toted down river, where they kill niggers with hard work and starving? I'd a heap rather die than go there any day. There's the time for you. Be off with Lizzie. You've got a pass to come and go any time. Come, bustle up, and I'll get your things together.
Tom slowly raised his head and looked sorrowfully, but quietly around, and said, No, no, I ain't going. Let Eliza go, it's her right. I wouldn't be the one to say no. Tain't nature for her to stay. But you heard what she said. If I must be sold, or all the people on this place and everything go to rack, why, let me be sold. I suppose I can bear it as well as any on 'em, he added, while something like a sob and a sigh shook his broad, rough chest convulsively. Massa always found me on the spot. He always will. I never have broke trust. Nor use my pass no ways contrary to my word, and I never will. It's better for me alone to go than to break up the place and sell all. Massa ain't to blame, Chloe, and he'll take care of you and the poor. Here he turned to the rough trundle bed full of little woolly heads, and broke fairly down. He leaned over the back of the chair and covered his face with his large hands. Sobs, heavy, hoarse, and loud, shook the chair, and great tears fell through his fingers on the floor. Just such tears, sir, as you dropped into the coffin where lay your first-born son. Such tears, woman, as you shed when you heard the cries of your dying babe. For, sir, he was a man, and you are but another man, and woman, though dressed in silk and jewels, you are but a woman. And in life's great straits and mighty griefs, you feel but one sorrow. And now, said Eliza, as she stood in the door, I saw my husband only this afternoon, and I little knew then what was to come. They have pushed him to the very last standing place, and he told me today that he was going to run away. Do try if you can't get word to him. Tell him how I went and why I went, and tell him I'm going to try and find Canada. You must give my love to him and tell him, if I never see him again. She turned away and stood with her back to them for a moment, and then added in a husky voice, tell him to be as good as he can, and try and meet me in the kingdom of heaven. Call Bruno in there, she added. Shut the door on him, poor beast. He mustn't go with me. A few last words and tears, a few simple adieus and blessings, and clasping her wondering and affrighted child in her arms, she glided noiselessly away.
Chapter 6 Discovery. Mr. and Mrs. Shelby, after their protracted discussion of the night before, did not readily sink to repose, and in consequence slept somewhat later than usual the ensuing morning. "I wonder what keeps Eliza," said Mrs. Shelby, after giving her bell repeated pulls to no purpose. Mr. Shelby was standing before his dressing-glass, sharpening his razor, and just then the door opened, and a colored boy entered with his shaving-water. "Andy," said his mistress, "step to Eliza's door, and tell her I have rung for her 3 times. Poor thing," she added to herself, with a sigh. Andy soon returned, with eyes very wide in astonishment.
"Law, missus! Lizzie's drawers is all open, and her things all lying every which way, and I believe she's just done cleared out."
The truth flashed upon Mr. Shelby and his wife at the same moment. He exclaimed, "Then she suspected it, and she's off."
"The Lord be thanked," said Mrs. Shelby. "I trust she is."
"Wife, you talk like a fool, really. It will be something pretty awkward for me if she is. Haley saw that I hesitated about selling this child, and he'll think I connived at it, to get him out of the way. It touches my honor."
And Mr. Shelby left the room hastily. There was great running and ejaculating and opening and shutting of doors and appearance of faces in all shades of color, in different places, for about a quarter of an hour. One person only, who might have shed some light on the matter, was entirely silent, and that was the head cook, Aunt Chloe. Silently, and with a heavy cloud settled down over her once joyous face, she proceeded making out her breakfast biscuits, as if she heard and saw nothing of the excitement round her. Very soon, about a dozen young imps were roosting, like so many crows, on the veranda railings, each one determined to be the first one to apprise the strange massa of his ill luck.
"He'll be rail mad, I'll be bound," said Andy. "Won't he swar?" said little black Jake.
"Yes, for he does swar," said woolly-headed Mandy. "I hearn him yesterday at dinner. I hearn all about it then, cause I got into the closet where Missus keeps the great jugs, and I hearn every word." And Mandy, who had never in her life thought of the meaning of a word she heard, more than a black cat, now took airs of superior wisdom and strutted about, forgetting to state that, though actually coiled up among the jugs at the time specified, she had been fast asleep all the time. When at last Haley appeared, booted and spurred, he was saluted with the bad tidings on every hand. The young imps on the veranda were not disappointed in their hope of hearing him swear, which he did with a fluency and fervency which delighted them all amazingly, as they ducked and dodged hither and thither, to be out of the reach of his riding whip. And all whooping off together, they tumbled in a pile of immeasurable giggle on the withered turf under the veranda, where they kicked up their heels and shouted to their full satisfaction.
"If I had the little devils," muttered Haley between his teeth.
"But you ain't got 'em, though," said Andy, with a triumphant flourish, and making a string of indescribable mouths at the unfortunate traitor's back, when he was fairly beyond hearing.
I say now, Shelby, this year's most extraordinary business," said Haley, as he abruptly entered the parlor. "Seems that gal's off with a young'un."
"Mr. Haley, Mrs. Shelby is present," said Mr. Shelby.
"I beg pardon, ma'am," said Haley, bowing slightly, with a still lowering brow. "But still I say, as I said before, this year's a singular report. Is it true, sir?"
"Sir," said Mr. Shelby, "if you wish to communicate with me, you must observe something of the decorum of a gentleman. Andy, take Mr. Haley's hat and riding whip. Take a seat, sir." "Yes, sir, I regret to say that the young woman, excited by overhearing or having reported to her something of this business, has taken her child in the night and made off."
"I did expect fair dealing in this matter, I confess," said Haley.
"Well, sir," said Mr. Shelby, turning sharply round upon him, "what am I to understand by that remark? If any man calls my honor in question, I have but one answer for him." The trader cowered at this, and in a somewhat lower tone said that it was plaguy hard on a fellow that had made a fair bargain to be gulled that way. "Mr. Haley," said Mr. Shelby, "if I did not think you had some cause for disappointment, I should not have borne from you the rude and unceremonious style of your entrance into my parlor this morning. I say thus much, however, since appearance calls for it, that I shall allow of no insinuations cast upon me, as if I were at all partner to any unfairness in this matter. Moreover, I shall feel bound to give you every assistance in the use of horses, servants, and sea, in the recovery of your property. So in short, Haley," said he, suddenly dropping from the tone of dignified coolness to his ordinary one of easy frankness, "the best way for you is to keep good-natured and eat some breakfast, and we will then see what is to be done." Mrs. Shelby now rose and said her engagements would prevent her being at the breakfast-table that morning, and deputing a very respectable mulatto woman to attend to the gentleman's coffee at the sideboard, she left the room.
"Old lady don't like your humble servant over and above," said Haley, with an uneasy effort to be very familiar.
"I am not accustomed to hear my wife spoken of with such freedom," said Mr. Shelby dryly.
"Beg pardon, of course, only a joke, you know," said Haley, forcing a laugh.
"Some jokes are less agreeable than others," rejoined Shelby.
"Devilish free. Now I've signed those papers, cuss him," muttered Haley to himself. "Quite grand since yesterday."
Never did fall of any prime minister at court occasion wider surges of sensation than the report of Tom's fate among his compeers on the place. It was the topic in every mouth, everywhere, and nothing was done in the house or in the field but to discuss its probable results. Eliza's flight, an unprecedented event on the place, was also a great accessory in stimulating the general excitement. Black Sam, as he was commonly called, from his being about three shades blacker than any other son of ebony on the place, was revolving the matter profoundly, in all its phases and bearings, with a comprehensiveness of vision and a strict lookout to his own personal well-being, that would have done credit to any white patriot in Washington. "It's an ill wind that blow nowhere. That are a fact," said Sam, sententiously, giving an additional hoist to his pantaloons and adroitly substituting a long nail in place of a missing suspender button, with which effort of mechanical genius he seemed highly delighted. "Yes, it's an ill wind blows nowhere," he repeated. "Now there's Tom down wall. Of course, there's room for some nigger to be up. And why not this nigger? That's the idea. Tom a-riding round the country, boots black, passing his pocket, all grand as koofy. But who's he? Now, why shouldn't Sam? That's what I want to know." "Hello, Sam? Oh, Sam, Master wants you to coach Bill and Jerry," said Andy, cutting short Sam's soliloquy. "Hi, what's afoot now, young'un?" "Why, you don't know. I suppose that Lily's cut stick and cleared out with a young'un." "You teach your granny," said Sam, with infinite contempt. "Knowed it a heap sight sooner than you did. This nigger ain't so green now." "Well, anyhow, Massa wants Bill and Jerry geared right up, and you and I's to go with Massa Haley to look arter her." "Good now, that's the time o' day," said Sam. "It's Sam that's called for in these here times. He's the nigger. See if I don't catch her now. Massa'll see what Sam can do." "Ah, but Sam," said Andy, "you'd better think twice, for Missus don't want her cotched, and she'll be in your wool." "Ah," said Sam, opening his eyes, "how'd you know that?" "Heard her say so, my own self, this blessed morning, when I bring in Massa's shaving water. She sent me to see why Lizzie didn't come to dress her, and when I told her she was off, she just res up and she says, 'The Lord be praised!' And Massa, he seemed real mad, and says he, 'Wife, you talk like a fool, but law, she'll bring him too. I knows well enough how that'll be. It's allers best to stand Missus side the fence, now I tell you.'" Black Sam, upon this, scratched his woolly plate, which, if it did not contain very profound wisdom, still contained a great deal of particular species much in demand among politicians of all complexions and countries, and vulgarly denominated, knowing which side the bread is buttered. So, stopping with grave consideration, he again gave a hitch to his pantaloons, which was his regularly organized method of assisting his mental perplexities. "There ain't no saying never about no kind of thing in this dear world," he said at last. Sam spoke like a philosopher, emphasizing this as if he had had a large experience in different sorts of worlds, and therefore had come to his conclusions advisedly. "Now certain I'd have said that Missus would have scoured this varsal world after Lizzie," said Sam, thoughtfully. "So she would," said Andy. "But can't you see through a ladder, you black nigger? Missus don't want dis year Massa Haley to get Lizzie's boy, dat's to go." "Ha," said Sam with an indescribable intonation, known only to those who have heard it among the negroes. "And I'll tell yer more'n all," said Andy. "I specs you better be making tracks for them horses. Mighty sudden, too, for I heard Missus quirin' arter yer, so you'd stop fooling long enough." Sam, upon this, began to bestir himself in real earnest, and after a while appeared bearing down gloriously towards the house, with Bill and Jerry in a full canter, and adroitly throwing himself off before they had any idea of stopping. He brought them up alongside of the horse-post like a tornado. Haley's horse, which was a skittish young colt, winced and bounced and pulled hard at his halter. "Ho-ho," said Sam, "skeery, are you?" And his black visage lighted up with a curious, mischievous gleam. "I'll fix you now," said he. There was a large beech tree overshadowing the place, and the small, sharp, triangular beech nuts lay scattered thickly on the ground. With one of these in his fingers, Sam approached the colt, stroked and patted, and seemed apparently busy in soothing his agitation. On pretense of adjusting the saddle, he adroitly slipped under it the sharp little nut, in such a manner that the least weight brought up on the saddle would annoy the nervous sensibilities of the animal, without leaving any perceptible graze or wound. "Dar," he said, rolling his eyes with an approving grin. "Me fix 'em." At this moment Mrs. Shelby appeared on the balcony, beckoning to him. Sam approached with as good a determination to pay court as did ever suitor ever vacant a place at St. James or Washington. "Why have you been loitering so, Sam? I sent Auntie to tell you to hurry." "Lord bless you, missus," said Sam. "Horses won't be cotched all in a minute. They done cleared out way down to the south pasture, and the Lord knows what."
"Sam, how often must I tell you not to say, 'Lord bless you,' and 'Lord knows,' and such things? It's wicked."
"Oh, Lord bless my soul, I don't forgot, missus. I won't say nothing of the sort no more."
"Why, Sam, you just have said it again."
"Did I? Oh, Lord, I mean, I didn't go fur to say—" "You must be careful, Sam. Just let me get my breath, missus, and I'll start fair. I'll be very careful." "Well, Sam, you are to go with Mr. Haley to show him the road and help him. Be careful of the horses, Sam. You know Jerry was a little lame last week. Don't ride them too fast." Mrs. Shelby spoke the last words with a low voice and strong emphasis. "Let this child alone for that," said Sam, rolling up his eyes with a volume of meaning. "Lord knows I didn't say that," said he, suddenly catching his breath, with a ludicrous flourish of apprehension which made his mistress laugh, spite of herself. "Yes, missus, I'll look out for the horses."
"Now, Andy," said Sam, returning to his stand under the beech trees, "you see, I wouldn't be at all surprised if dat ar gentleman's critter should give a fling by and by when he comes to be a-gettin' up. You know, Andy, critters will do such things." And therewith Sam poked Andy in the side in a highly suggestive manner.
"Ha!" said Andy, with an air of instant appreciation.
"Yes, you see, Andy, missus wants to make time. Dat's a clar to your most ordinary observer. I just make a little for her. Now, you see, get all dese yer horses loose, caperin' permiscus round dis yer lot, and down to de wood dar, and I spect massa won't be off in a hurry." Andy grinned.
"You see," said Sam, "you see, Andy, if any such thing should happen as that Massa Harry horse should begin to act contrary and cut up, you and I just let's go of ourn to help him. And we'll help him, oh yes."
And Sam and Andy laid their heads back on their shoulders and broke into a low and moderate laugh, snapping their fingers and flourishing their heels with exquisite delight. At that instant, Haley appeared on the veranda. Somewhat mollified by certain cups of very good coffee, he came out smiling and talking in tolerably restored humor, Sam and Andy clawing for certain fragmentary palm leaves, which they were in the habit of considering as hats, flew to the horse-post to be ready to help Massa. Sam's palm leaf had been ingeniously disentangled from all pretensions to braid, as respect its brim, and the slivers starting apart and standing upright gave it a blazing air of freedom and defiance, quite equal to that of any Fiji chief. While the whole brim of Andy's being departed bodily, he rapped the crown on his head with a dexterous thump, and looked about well pleased as if to say, "Who says I haven't got a hat?"
"Well, boys," said Harry, "look alive now, we must lose no time."
"Not a bit of time, master," said Sam, putting Harry's rein in his hand, and holding his stirrup while Andy was untying the other two horses. The instant Harry touched the saddle, the meddlesome creature bounded from the earth with a sudden spring that threw his master sprawling from feet off on the soft, dry turf. Sam, with frantic ejaculations, made a dive at the reins, but only succeeded in brushing and blazing palm leaf aforenamed into the horse's eyes, which by no means tended to allay the confusion of his nerves. So with great vehemence he overturned Sam, and giving two or three contemptuous snorts, flourished his heels vigorously in the air, and was soon prancing away towards the lower end of the lawn, followed by Bill and Jerry, whom Andy had not failed to let loose, according to contract, speeding them off with various direful ejaculations. And now ensued a miscellaneous scene of confusion. Sam and Andy ran and shouted, dogs barked here and there, and Mike, Mose, Mandy, Fanny, and all the smaller specimens on the place, both man and female, raced, clapped hands, whooped, and shouted with outrageous officiousness and untiring zeal. Haley's horse, which was a white one and very fleet and spirited, appeared to enter into the spirit of the scene with great gusto, and having for his coursing ground a lawn of nearly half a mile in extent, gently sloping down on every side into indefinite woodland, he appeared to take infinite delight in seeing how near he could allow his pursuers to approach him, and then, when within a hand's breadth, whisk off, with a start and a snort, like a mischievous beast, as he was, and career far down into some alley of the woodlot. Nothing was further from Sam's mind than to have any one of the troop taken until such season as should seem to him most befitting, and the exertions that he made were certainly most heroic, like the sword of Coeur de Lion, which always blazed in the front and thickest of the battle. Sam's palm leaf was to be seen everywhere when there was the least danger that a horse could be caught. There he would bear down full tilt, shouting, "Now for it! Catch him! Catch him!" in a way that would set everything to indiscriminate rout in a moment. Haley ran up and down and cursed and swore and stamped miscellaneously. Mr. Shelby in vain tried to shout directions from the balcony, and Mrs. Shelby from her chamber window alternately laughed and wondered, not without some inkling of what lay at the bottom of all this confusion. At last, about 12 o'clock, Sam appeared triumphant, mounted on Jerry with Haley's horse by his side, reeking with sweat, but with flashing eyes and dilated nostrils, showing that the spirit of freedom had not yet entirely subsided. "He's cotched!" he exclaimed triumphantly. "If it hadn't been for me, they might have bust themselves all on him, but I cotched him."
"You!" growled Haley, in no amiable mood. "If it hadn't been for you, this never would have happened."
"Law bless us, master," said Sam, in a tone of the deepest concern, "and me that has been racing and chasing till the sweat just pours off me." "Well, well," said Haley, "you've lost me near 3 hours with your cursed nonsense. Now let's be off, and have no more fooling."
"Why, master," said Sam in a depreciating tone, "I believe you mean to kill us all clear, horses and all. Here we are, all just ready to drop down, and the critters all in a reek of sweat. Why, master, won't think of it starting on now till arter dinner. Master's horses wants rubbing down. See how he splashed hisself, and Jerry limps, too. Don't think missus would be willing to have us start dis your way. No how. Lord bless you, master, we can catch up if we do stop. Lizzie never was so great of a walker."
Mrs. Shelby, who greatly to her amusement had overheard this conversation from the veranda, now resolved to do her part. She came forward and, courteously expressing her concern for Harry's accident, pressed him to stay to dinner, saying that the cook should bring it on the table immediately. Thus, all things considered, Harry, with rather an equivocal grace, proceeded to the parlour, while Sam, rolling his eyes after him with unutterable meaning, proceeded gravely with the horses to the stable-yard.
"Did you see him, Andy? Did you see him?"
said Sam, when he had got fairly beyond the shelter of the barn and fastened the horse to a post.
"Oh, Lord, if it weren't as good as a meeting now, to see him a-dancing and kicking and swearing at us. Didn't I hear him swear?
Swear away, old fellow," says I to myself. "Will you have your horse now, or wait till you catch him?" says I. "Lord, Andy, I think I can see him now." And Sam and Andy leaned up against the barn and laughed to their heart's content.
"You ought to seen how mad he looked when I brought the horse up. Lord, he'd have killed me if he dared to. And there I was standing as innocent and as humble." "Lord, I see you," said Andy. "Ain't you an old horse, Sam?"
"Rather specs I am," said Sam. "Do you see Missus upstairs at the winder?"
"I see her laughing."
"I'm sure. I was racing so I didn't see nothing," said Andy. "Well, you see," said Sam, proceeding gravely to wash down Harry's pony. "I's acquired what you all may call a habit, oh, observation, Andy. It's a very important habit, Andy, and I commend you to be cultivating it now you're young." "Hist up that hind foot, Andy. You see, Andy, it's bobservation. Makes all the difference in niggers. Didn't I see which way the wind blew dis your morning? Didn't I see what missus wanted, though she never let on? That's our bobservation, Andy."
"I specs. It's what you may call a faculty. Faculties is different in different peoples, but cultivation of 'em goes a great way."
"I guess if I hadn't helped your bobservation this morning, you wouldn't have seen your way so smart," said Andy.
"Andy," said Sam, "you're a promising child. There ain't no manner of doubt. I think lots of you, Andy, and I don't feel no ways ashamed to take ideas from you. We oughtn't to overlook nobody, Andy, 'cause the smartest of us gets tripped up sometimes. And so, Andy, let's go up to the house now. I'll be bound Missus will give us an uncommon good bite this year time."
Chapter 7. The Mother's Struggle. It is impossible to conceive of a human creature more wholly desolate and forlorn than Eliza, when she turned her footsteps from Uncle Tom's cabin. Her husband's suffering and dangers, and the danger of her child, all blended in her mind, with a confused and stunning sense of the risk she was running in leaving the only home she had ever known and cutting loose from the protection of a friend whom she loved and revered. Then there was the parting from every familiar object, the place where she had grown up, the trees under which she had played, the groves where she had walked many an evening in happier days by the side of her young husband. Everything, as it lay in the clear frosty starlight, seemed to speak reproachfully to her, and ask her whither could she go from a home like that. But stronger than all was maternal love, wrought into a paroxysm of frenzy by the near approach of a fearful danger. Her boy was old enough to have walked by her side, and in an indifferent case she would only have led him by the hand. But now the bare thought of putting him out of her arms made her shudder, and she strained him to her bosom with a convulsive grasp as she went rapidly forward. The frosty ground creaked beneath her feet, and she trembled at the sound. Every quaking leaf and fluttering shadow sent the blood backward to her heart, and quickened her footsteps. She wondered within herself at the strength that seemed to become upon her, for she felt the weight of her boy as if it had been a feather. And every flutter of fear seemed to increase the supernatural power that bore her on, while from her pale lips burst forth, in frequent ejaculations, the prayer to a friend above, "Lord help, Lord save me." If it were your Harry, mother, or your Willie, that were going to be torn from you by a brutal traitor, tomorrow morning, if you had seen the man and heard that the papers were signed and delivered, and you had only from 12 o'clock till morning to make good your escape, how fast could you walk? How many miles could you make in those few brief hours, with the darling at your bosom, the little sleepy head on your shoulder, the small soft arms trustingly holding onto your neck? For the child slept. At first the novelty and alarm kept him waking, but his mother so hurriedly repressed every breath or sound, and so assured him that if he were only still she would certainly save him, that he clung quietly round her neck, only asking, as he found himself sinking to sleep, "Mother, I don't need to keep awake, do I?" "No, my darling, sleep, if you want to."
"But, mother, if I do get sleep, you won't let him get me?"
"No. So may God help me," said his mother, with a paler cheek and a brighter light in her large dark eyes.
"You're sure, ain't you, mother?"
"Yes, sure," said the mother, in a voice that startled herself, for it seemed to her to come from a spirit within that was no part of her, and the boy dropped his little weary head on her shoulder, and was soon asleep. How the touch of those warm arms, the gentle breathings that came in her neck, seemed to add fire and spirit to her movements. It seemed to her as if strength poured into her in electric streams from every gentle touch and movement of the sleeping, confiding child. Sublime is the dominion of the mind over the body that for a time can make flesh and nerves impregnable and string the sinews like steel so that the weak become so mighty. The boundaries of the farm, the grove, the wood lot, passed by her dizzily as she walked on and still she went, leaving one familiar object after another, slacking not, pausing not, till reddening daylight found her many a long mile from all traces of any familiar objects upon the open highway. She had often been with her mistress to visit some connections in the little village of T, not far from the Ohio River, and knew the road well. To go thither, to escape across the Ohio River, were the first hurried outlines of her plan of escape. Beyond that, she could only hope in God. When horses and vehicles began to move along the highway, with that alert perception peculiar to a state of excitement, and which seems to be a sort of inspiration, she became aware that her headlong pace and distracted air might bring on her remark and suspicion. She therefore put the boy on the ground, and adjusting her dress and bonnet, she walked on at as rapid a pace as she thought consistent with the preservation of appearances. In her little bundle she had provided a store of cakes and apples, which she used as expedients for quickening the speed of the child, rolling the apples some yards before them, when the boy would run with all his might after it, and this ruse, often repeated, carried them over many a half-mile. After a while they came to a thick patch of woodland, through which murmured a clear brook. As the child complained of hunger and thirst, she climbed over the fence with him, and sitting down behind a large rock, which concealed them from the road, she gave him a breakfast out of her little package. The boy wondered and grieved that she could not eat, and when putting his arms round her neck, he tried to wedge some of his cake into her mouth. It seemed to her that the rising in her throat would choke her. "No, no, Harry, darling. Mother can't eat till you are safe. We must go on till we come to the river." And she hurried again into the road, and again constrained herself to walk regularly and composedly forward. She was many miles past any neighborhood where she was personally known. If she should chance to meet any who knew her, she reflected that the well-known kindness of the family would be of itself a blind to suspicion, as making it an unlikely supposition that she could be a fugitive, as she was also so white as not to be known as of colored lineage, without a critical survey. And her child was white also. It was much easier for her to pass on unsuspected. On this presumption she stopped at noon at a neat farmhouse to rest herself, and buy some dinner for her child and self, for as the danger decreased with the distance, the supernatural tension of the nervous system lessened, and she found herself both weary and hungry. The good woman, kindly and gossiping, seemed rather pleased than otherwise with having somebody come in to talk with, and accepted without examination Eliza's statement that she was going on a little piece to spend a week with her friends, all which she hoped in her heart might prove strictly true. An hour before sunset she entered the village of T, by the Ohio River, weary and footsore, but still strong in heart. Her first glance was at the river, which lay like Jordan between her and the Canaan of liberty on the other side. It was now early spring, and the river was swollen and turbulent. Great cakes of floating ice were swinging heavily to and fro in the turbid waters. Owing to the peculiar form of the shore on the Kentucky side, the land bending far out into the water, the ice had been lodged and detained in great quantities, and the narrow channel, which swept round the bend, was full of ice, piled one cake over another, thus forming a temporary barrier to the descending ice, which lodged and formed a great undulating raft, filling up the whole river and extending almost to the Kentucky shore. Eliza stood for a moment, contemplating this unfavorable aspect of things, which she saw at once must prevent the usual ferry boat from running, and then turned into a small public house on the bank to make a few inquiries. The hostess, who was busy in various fizzing and stewing operations over the fire, preparatory to the evening meal, stopped with a fork in her hand as Eliza's sweet and plaintive voice arrested her. "What is it?" she said. "Isn't there any ferry or boat that takes people over to B?" "Now?" she said. "No, indeed," said the woman. "The boats has stopped running." Eliza's look of dismay and disappointment struck the woman, and she said inquiringly, "Maybe you're wanting to get over. Anybody sick? You seem mighty anxious." "I've got a child that's very dangerous," said Eliza. "I never heard of it till last night, and I've walked quite a piece today in hopes to get to the ferry." "Well, now, that's unlucky," said the woman, whose motherly sympathies were much aroused. "I'm really concerned for you." "Solomon," she called from the window, towards a small back building. A man in leather apron and very dirty hands appeared at the door.
"I say so," said the woman. "Is that our man going to tote them barrels over tonight?"
"He said he should try, if 'twas any way prudent," said the man.
"There's a man apiece down here that's going over with some truck this evening. If he does to, he'll be in here to supper tonight, so you'd better sit down and wait. That's a sweet little fellow," added the woman, offering him a cake.
But the child, wholly exhausted, cried with weariness.
"Poor fellow. He isn't used to walking, and I've hurried him on so," said Eliza.
"Well, take him into this room," said the woman, opening into a small bedroom, where stood a comfortable bed. Eliza laid the weary boy upon it, and held his hands in hers till he was fast asleep. For her there was no rest. As a fire in her bones, the thought of the pursuer urged her on, and she gazed with longing eyes on the sullen, surging waters that lay between her and liberty. Here we must take our leave for her for the present, to follow the course of her pursuers. Though Mrs. Shelby had promised that the dinner should be hurried on table, yet it was soon seen, as the thing had often been seen before, that it required more than one to make a bargain. So although the order was fairly given out in Haley's hearing, and carried to Aunt Chloe, by at least half a dozen juvenile messengers, that dignitary only gave certain very gruff snorts and tosses of her head, and went on with every operation in an unusually leisurely and circumstantial manner. For some singular reason an impression seemed to reign among the servants generally, that Mrs. would not be particularly disobliged by delay, and it was wonderful that a number of counter-accidents occurred constantly to retard the course of things. One luckless wit contrived to upset the gravy, and then gravy had to be got up de novo, with due care and formality, Aunt Chloe watching and stirring with dogged precision, answering shortly to all suggestions of haste, that she weren't going to have raw gravy on the table to help nobody's catchins. One tumbled down with the water, and had to go to the spring for more, and another precipitated the butter into the path of events, and there was from time to time giggling news brought into the kitchen, that Massa Haley was mighty uneasy, and that he couldn't sit in his cheer no ways, but was a-walkin' and stalkin' to the winders and through the porch.
"Serves him right," said Aunt Chloe indignantly. "He'll get what's nor uneasy one of these days if he don't mend his ways. His master'll be sending for him, and then see how he'll look."
"He'll go to torment, and no mistake," said little Jake.
"He deserves it," said Aunt Chloe, grimly. "He's broke a many, many, many hearts, I tell y'all," she said, stopping with a fork uplifted in her hands. "It's like what Master George reads in Revelations. Souls a-callin' under the altar, and a-callin' on the Lord for vengeance on sich. And by and by the Lord he'll hear him, so he will."
Aunt Chloe, who was much revered in the kitchen, was listened to with open mouth, and the dinner being now fairly sent in, the whole kitchen was at leisure to gossip with her and to listen to her remarks.
"Sich'll be burnt up forever, and no mistake, won't there?" said Andy.
"I'd be glad to see it, I'll be bound," said little Jake.
"Chillin'," said a voice that made them all start.
It was Uncle Tom, who had come in and stood listening to the conversation at the door.
"Chillin'," he said, "I'm afraid you don't know what you're saying. Forever is a dreadful word. Chillin', it's awful to think on it. You oughtn't to wish that are to any human critter."
"We wouldn't to anybody but the soul drivers," said Andy. "Nobody can help wishing it to them. They're so awful wicked."
"Don't nature herself kind of cry out on him?" said Aunt Chloe. "Don't dare tear their sucking baby right off his mother's breast and sell him, and their little children, as is crying and holding on by her clothes, don't they pull him off and sell him? Don't they tear wife and husband apart?" said Aunt Chloe, beginning to cry, "when it's just taking the very life on him. And all the while, does they feel one bit? Don't they drink and smoke and take it on common easy? Law, if the devil don't get them, what's he good for?"
And Aunt Chloe covered her face with her checkered apron and began to sob in good earnest.
"Pray for them that spitefully use you, the good book says Tom.
"Pray for 'em," says Aunt Chloe. "Law, it's too tough. I can't pray for 'em."
"It's nature, Chloe, and nature's strong," said Tom. "But the Lord's grace is stronger. Besides, you ought to think what an awful state a poor creature's soul is in that'll do our things. You ought to thank God that you ain't like him, Chloe. I'm sure I'd rather be sold 10,000 times over than to have all that our poor critter's got to answer for."
"So'd I, a heap," said Jake. "Law, shouldn't we cotch it, Andy?"
Andy shrugged his shoulders and gave an acquiescent whistle.
"I'm glad Master didn't go off this morning as he looked to," said Tom. "That hurt me more than selling it did. Maybe it might have been natural for him, but it would have come desperate hard on me, as has known him from a baby. But I've seen Massa, and I begin to feel sort of reconciled to the Lord's will now. Massa couldn't help hisself. He did right, but I'm feared things will be kind of going to rack when I'm gone. Massa can't be expected to be a-prying round everywhere as I've done, keeping up all the ends.
The boys all means well, but they's powerful careless. That all troubles me.
The bell here rang, and Tom was summoned to the parlor.
Tom, said his master kindly, I want you to notice that I give this gentleman bonds to forfeit $1,000 if you are not on the spot when he wants you. He's going today to look after his other business, and you can have the day to yourself. Go anywhere you like, boy.
Thank you, massa, said Tom.
And mind yourself, said the trader, and don't come it over your master with any of your nigger tricks, for I'll take every cent out of him if he ain't there. If he'd hear to me, he wouldn't trust any on you, slippery as eels.
Massa, said Tom, and he stood very straight. I was just 8 years old when old missus put you into my arms, and you wasn't a year old.
That, says she, Tom, that's to be your young massa. Take good care on him, says she. And now I just ask you, massa, have I ever broke word to you, or gone contrary to you, especially since I was a Christian?
Mr. Shelby was fairly overcome, and the tears rose to his eyes.
My good boy, said he, the Lord knows you say but the truth, and if I was able to help it, all the world shouldn't buy you.
And sure as I am a Christian woman, said Mrs. Shelby, you shall be redeemed as soon as I can, any way, bring together means.
Sir, she said to Haley, take good account of who you sell him to, and let me know.
Law, yes, for that matter, said the trader. I may bring him up in a year, not much the worse for wear, and trade him back.
I'll trade with you then, and make it for your advantage, said Mrs. Shelby.
Of course, said the trader. All's equal with me. Lives trade him up and down, so I does a good business. All I want is a living, you know, ma'am. That's all any of us wants, I suppose.
Mr. and Mrs. Shelby both felt annoyed and degraded by the familiar impudence of the trader, and yet both saw the absolute necessity of putting a constraint on their feelings. The more hopelessly sordid and insensible he appeared, the greater became Mrs. Shelby's dread of his succeeding in recapturing Eliza and her child, and of course the greater her motive for detaining him by every female artifice. She therefore graciously smiled, assented, chatted familiarly, and did all she could to make time pass imperceptibly. At 2 o'clock Sam and Andy brought the horses up to the posts, apparently greatly refreshed and invigorated by the scamper of the morning. Sam was there new-oiled from dinner, with an abundance of zealous and ready officiousness. As Haley approached, he was boasting in flourishing style to Andy of the evident and eminent success of the operation, now that he had fairly come to it.
"Your master, I suppose, don't keep no dogs," said Haley, thoughtfully, as he prepared to mount.
"Heaps on 'em," said Sam triumphantly. "There's Bruno. He's a roarer. And besides that, about every nigger of us keeps a pup of some nature or other."
"Pooh," said Haley.
And he said something else, too, with regard to the said dogs, at which Sam muttered, "I don't see no use cussing on him, no way." "But your master don't keep no dogs."
"I pretty much know he don't. For tracking out niggers."
Sam knew exactly what he meant, but he kept on a look of earnest and desperate simplicity.
"Our dogs all smells round considerable sharp. I spect they's the kind, though they hain't never had no practice. They's far dogs, though, at most anything. If you'd get 'em started. Here, Bruno," he called, whistling to the lumbering Newfoundland, who came pitching tumultuously towards them.
"You go hang," said Haley, getting up. "Come, tumble up now."
Sam tumbled up accordingly, dexterously contriving to tickle Andy as he did so, which occasioned Andy to split out into a laugh greatly to Haley's indignation, who made a cut at him with his riding whip.
"I astonished at yer, Andy," said Sam, with awful gravity. "This is yer's a serious business, Andy. Yer mustn't be a-making game. This yer ain't no way of help, masser."
"I shall take the straight road to the river," said Haley, decidedly, after they had come to the boundaries of the estate. "I know the way of all of 'em. They make tracks for the underground."
"Sartin," said Sam, "that's the idee. Massa Haley hits de ding right in de middle. Now dere's two roads to de river, de dirt road and de pike. Which massa mean to take?"
Andy looked up innocently at Sam, surprised at hearing this new geographical fact, but instantly confirmed what he said by a vehement reiteration.
"Call," said Sam, "I'd rather be inclined to imagine that Lizzie take de dirt road, being it's the least travel."
Haley, notwithstanding that he was a very old bird and naturally inclined to be suspicious of chaff, was rather brought up by this view of the case. "If you weren't both on your such cuss liars now," he said contemplatively, as he pondered a moment. The pensive, reflective tone in which this was spoken appeared to muse Andy prodigiously, and he drew a little behind and shook so, apparently, to run a great risk of falling off his horse, while Sam's face was immovably composed into the most doleful gravity.
"Course," said Sam, "massa can do as he'd rather. Go de straight road if massa thinks best. It's all one to us. Now, when I study pon, I think de straight road de best," deridedly.
"She would naturally go a lonesome way," said Haley, thinking aloud, and not minding Sam's remarks.
"Dar, aren't no sayin'," said Sam, Gals is peculiar. They never done nothing you thinks they will. Mo's generally the contrary. Gals is naturally made contrary, and so, if you thinks they gone one road, it is sartin you better go t'other, and then you'll be sure to find him. Now, my private opinion is Lizzie took the road, so I think we better take the straight one. This profound generic view of the female sex did not seem to dispose Haley particularly to the straight road, and he announced decidedly that he should go to the other, and ask Sam when they should come to it. A little piece ahead, said Sam, giving a wink to Andy with the eye, which was on Andy's side of the head, and he added gravely, But I've studied on the matter, and I'm quite clear. We ought not to go da our way. I never been over it, no way. It's desperate lonesome, and we might lose our way. Where we'd come to, the Lord only knows. Nevertheless, said Haley, I shall go that way. Now I think on it. I think I learn him tell that our road all fenced up and down by the creek. And there ain't it, Andy? Andy wasn't certain. He'd only heard tell about that road, but never been over it. In short, he was strictly non-committal. Haley, accustomed to strike the balance of probabilities between lies of greater or lesser magnitude, thought that it lay in favor of the dirt road aforesaid. The mention of the thing he thought he perceived was involuntary on Sam's part at first, and his confused attempts to dissuade him he set down to a desperate lying on second thoughts, as being unwilling to implicate Liza. When, therefore, Sam indicated the road, Haley plunged briskly into it, followed by Sam and Andy. Now the road, in fact, was an old one, that had formerly been a thoroughfare to the river, but abandoned for many years after the laying of the new pike. It was open for about an hour's ride, and after that it was cut across by various farms and fences. Sam knew this fact perfectly well. Indeed, the road had been so long closed up that Andy had never heard of it. He therefore rode along with an air of dutiful submission, only groaning and vociferating occasionally that 'twas desp rough and bad for Jerry's foot. Now, I just give your warning, said Haley. I know yer. Yer won't get me to turn off this road with all your fussin', so you shut up. Massa will go his own way, said Sam, with rueful submission, at the same time winking most portentously to Andy, whose delight was now very near the explosive point. Sam was in wonderful spirits, professed to keep a very brisk lookout, at one time exclaiming that he saw a gal's bonnet on the top of some distant eminence, or calling to Andy, If that there wasn't Lizzie down in the hollow? Always making these exclamations in some rough or craggy part of the road, where the sudden quickening of speed was a special inconvenience to all parties concerned, and thus keeping Haley in a state of constant commotion. After riding about an hour in this way, the whole party made a precipitate and tumultuous descent into a barnyard, belonging to a large farming establishment. Not a soul was in sight, all the hands being employed in the fields, but as the barn stood conspicuously and plainly square across the road, it was evident that their journey in that direction had reached a decided finale. "'Wasn't dat ar what I told massa?' said Sam, with an air of injured innocence. "'How does strange gentlemen expect to know more about a country than the natives born and raised?' "'You rascal,' said Haley. "'You knew all about this. Didn't I tell yer? I knowed, and yer wouldn't believe me. I tell you, master, was all shut up and fenced up, and I didn't expect we could get through. Andy heard me.' It was all too true to be disputed, and the unlucky man had to pocket his wrath with the best grace he was able, and all three faced to the right about, and took up their line of march for the highway. In consequence of all the various delays, it was about 3/4 of an hour after Eliza had laid her child to sleep in the village tavern that the party came riding into the same place. Eliza was standing by the window looking out in another direction when Sam's quick eye caught a glimpse of her. Haley and Andy were 2 yards behind. At this crisis, Sam contrived to have his hat blown off, and uttered a loud and characteristic ejaculation which startled her at once, and drew suddenly back. The whole train swept by the window, round to the front door. 1,000 lives seemed to be concentrated in that one moment to Eliza. Her room opened by a side door to the river. She caught her child, and sprang down the steps towards it. The trader caught a full glimpse of her just as she was disappearing down the bank, and throwing himself from his horse and calling loudly on Sam and Andy, he was after her like a hound after a deer. In that dizzy moment her feet to her scarce seemed to touch the ground, and a moment brought her to the water's edge. Right on behind they came, and nerved with strength such as God gives only to the desperate, with one wild cry and flying leap, she vaulted sheer over the turbid current by the shore, onto the raft of ice beyond. It was a desperate leap, impossible to anything but madness and despair, and Haley, Sam, and Andy instinctively cried out, and lifted up their hands as she did it. The huge green fragment of ice on which she alighted pitched and creaked as her weight came on it. But she stayed there not a moment.
With wild cries and desperate energy, she leaped to another, and still another, cake tumbling, leaping, slipping, springing upwards again. Her shoes are gone, her stockings cut from her feet, while blood marked every step, but she saw nothing.